Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 74, Behavioral Medicine, Chinese Medicine, and Monastic Psychology, February 2nd, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
A lot of us kind of grew up a little bit bigoted, you know, our God's better than your God and all of that. And what the church teaches very clearly today is that we all share in the truth, and we share in it in different ways and different degrees, and we emphasize different things. So that has led me into some of the work that I do with monastic interreligious dialogue, with bridging the gap between East and West, spiritually and in terms of medicine and meditation and so forth.
That was the voice of my guest, Brother Bernard Seif. Brother and Dr. Bernard Seif, SMC, EDD, NMD, is a Catholic monk and a clinical psychologist, board certified in behavioral medicine. He's also a doctor of natural medicine, specializing in Chinese medicine, with subspecialties in medical qigong and Chinese medicinal herbs. Brother Bernard enjoys doing spiritual direction and giving retreats and workshops in America and abroad. Here's the interview. Brother Bernard Seif, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Dave. It's really a delight to be here and an honor.
Well, I'm really pleased. This is another instance of a listener who is converted to a guest, and I'm always excited when that happens. And you are such an interesting blend of backgrounds and trainings and skills and orientations that I hardly know where to start. But one of the things is, probably one of the most salient things to me, is that you're a Catholic monk. And we've exchanged some emails back and forth. And a question I haven't asked you is, what order?
I entered the Oblates of St. Francis de Sales at 17. That's a large order, international.
Really?
And was part of that for most of my life. I went in after high school. It was the order that taught me. And took vows as a religious brother and so forth. And I did a lot of varying ministry, including helping other guys who were coming into the community to be priests and brothers in our order, and teaching, college teaching, high school teaching, retreat work, and so forth. But I always had a longing to be a monk, which is a little more monastic, more emphasis on silence and meditation and so forth. But I love the spirit of St. Francis de Sales and St. Jane de Chantal. So after Vatican Council II, which created a lot of changes in the church, and actually it's going to take some generations till the deeper meanings of that major council has its impact. Canon law was updated, and there was a canon in there that provided for people to live monastic life as a more solitary monk or nun, and I received permission from Rome to transition, and then my monastic vows were received by a local bishop. So I still live the spirit of St. Francis de Sales and St. Jane de Chantal, but live it as a monk now, so I'm not part of a large order.
Okay, and so then you don't live in a monastery then?
I do live in a little monastery, yes. We were about five members. I was by myself when I made this transition in the late 80s, and was open to whatever way God wanted to refashion things. I knew I had a sense of my call and had all the appropriate permissions. And then various people came along to live in community with us. Some took vows as monastics and a nun, another monk, and some people were with us for a period of years. Some live associated with the monastery. Their vocation is really to marriage or single life in another setting, but share in our life. So I do live with, there's a couple buildings here. There's a nun on the property. There's myself. There are retreatants who come and go, and my clients who are in and out all day. So it's a small community compared to the larger communities that I've lived in earlier on, some of which were over 100 in number.
Okay, and so would this look like a collection of houses in the country?
Yes, we're very much in the country. It's a small property. It's maybe an acre and a third. There's a regular-looking house. It's kind of big. And then there's a little chapel that looks a little bit like a barn. The Amish actually made it and brought it here and set it up for us. And then there is a white mobile home. As we grew, when I was by myself, my office and chapel, everything was in one little house. But then as we grew, we created the chapel, which in monastic life in a little monastery you call an oratory. So the oratory. And then I needed a place to kind of move my office so that we could have more privacy. And I bought an old white mobile home, and that got put on the property. So now we have those three buildings.
Thanks. That helps me to have a picture, and our listeners to kind of have a picture of your setting, because generally when you hear the word monastery, the picture that comes up in my mind is something that looks like an old European castle or something like that.
That's very true. And, you know, sadly, many of those are kind of museums today, but the real monastic is the one is the life that is lived within the person. So it is not that all the arches. I sometimes say, if you want arches, go to McDonald's. But we live a very simple life here, yeah. And it's nicely integrated into the local community. People know us. When I go out for a run, they'll wave and say, hi, brother, and they know us at the post office and so forth. So it's kind of nice.
Oh, yeah, that sounds wonderful. Well, you've already, you know, I've got a lot of ground that I want to cover, but you've already said a couple things that make me want to backtrack a little bit and find out a little bit more. One is you made reference to, did you say the council? It wasn't the Council of Trent, was it?
No, but you're close. It was Vatican Council II.
Thank you. That's it.
Yes.
And you said something about the deeper meanings that would take 2 or 3 years more, perhaps, to unfold. And I wonder if just kind of briefly you could give us a sense of what those deeper meanings are.
Sure. Actually, 2 or 3 generations.
Oh, generations. More to unfold. Yeah.
When people think of the changes in the church, and I'm talking about all churches, but primarily the Roman Catholic tradition, they'll think largely of the liturgy being put into the vernacular, and in this country that would be English in most places, or Spanish, or whatever the local community celebrates in or communicates in. Or they'll think of sisters who and brothers who maybe aren't wearing habits or not wearing habits the way they used to. Maybe they're simplified. They'll think of those things which are somewhat more surfacey in a sense, although they're important. And the deeper meanings are things like the universal call to holiness, that all people are loved by God and all share in this call, not just clergy and monastics, which was kind of a distorted theology. So that was very much emphasized, and that's why you'll see a lot of married people or secular people doing various ministries today that they would not have thought themselves able to do in the past.
And so it sounds like it's a much broader vision, and perhaps that helps to explain why your activities are so much broader, both spiritually and intellectually, than would fit in my stereotypes of Catholicism.
Yes, and I do run across a lot of stereotypical thinking with folks, but one of the areas that I think interests me a lot with the changes in the church and Vatican II is the deeper meanings of ecumenism. A lot of us kind of grew up a little bit bigoted, you know, our God's better than your God and all of that. And what the church teaches very clearly today is that we all share in the truth, and we share in it in different ways and different degrees, and we emphasize different things. So that has led me into some of the work that I do with monastic interreligious dialogue, with bridging the gap between East and West, spiritually and in terms of medicine and meditation and so forth.
Yeah, good, because it's those differences in religious dogma that are tearing the world apart today. So that sort of healing and bridging is needed more than ever before.
Yes.
Now, the other thing that grabbed my interest, and I don't even feel like we're fully into this yet, but was that you entered the order at the age of 17. So what was behind that? You know, that to me is a young age, and so you must have had some early life experiences or some special orientation that would have given you this passion at such a young age.
Yes. Looking back on it, I sort of cringe and think, oh, 17, how did I do that? But, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia in a wonderful neighborhood, kind of tough. Now it's really a dangerous neighborhood, actually. But lots of people, lots of row homes. You go out and clean your steps and sweep up. And we worked hard. We didn't have much, but you kind of made ends meet. And every year, droves of people went into religious life. Actually, one of my sisters, I'm one of six, there were six of us, is a sister of St. Joseph. So there were two in our family, and I think 90 young women entered with her. And it was often done right out of high school. Many times you went to a high school that an order ran, or a number of different religious orders together, and you would wind up going into one of those orders. So after high school was not that young in those days. Today, you would certainly not go in that young. The order would want you to have more life experience or education, something like that. In fact, I ran a house of studies for our order for 9 years, and some of them came in older than I was when I was in charge of them. They would be coming in out of the military or whatever, and it was actually like that initially in the history of religious orders and religious life. People were typically older, but anyway, I went in at 17, and I didn't have a clear understanding. I just knew I had a sense of wanting to focus a little bit more on loving God and loving other people. I think the same part of the, perhaps the same motivation that called me to psychology called me to religious life. And I know you sometimes are curious as to how did somebody become a psychologist.
Yes.
I remember.
You've been listening.
Yes, I sure have, and enjoying every minute of it. At my first memory, I think I was about 5 years old, is of I can see myself standing there in our house and in short pants, and the sun's coming in the window. And I had an intense moment of wanting to help people stop hurting inside. And I think that monasticism and psychology, the healing arts, were kind of woven together somehow from that point on. I mean, I had a youth like everybody else, and friends, and dating, and all of that. But there was just a sense of this would be the best way I could focus my life and my energies on something worthwhile. And so then I entered the community.
Okay, now you mentioned dating, and so that makes me wonder if part of your practice of being a monk, it makes me wonder, have you ever been married? Have you taken a vow of celibacy?
Yes, actually, it's a vow of chastity. It's one of the monastic vows.
Okay.
In monastic life, a main ingredient is celibacy and chastity. So for a monk or a nun of any tradition, Hindu, Buddhist, Catholic, some version of a commitment or a vow of chastity is integral to that life. So there will not be a change in church law or something that will allow monks and nuns to marry because it's an essential ingredient. That's not true for the priesthood, however.
Okay. I wonder if you think that there's, if you see a connection between celibacy and the accumulation of spiritual energy. I'm thinking of chi, kundalini, you know, there are various words for that. And I think in some of the Eastern monastic traditions, that's part of the story. And what's been your experience with that?
Yes, I didn't think in those terms earlier on in my life, but in more recent years, as I've grown a little bit in my understanding of chi and so forth, I do think that this focused attention on seeking God and at the fruit of that being service to others does heighten one's energy or ability to love and to serve. We are all sexual beings. We need to live it in a way that is appropriate for our life or our commitments. So for me, it's celibacy. For a married person, it would be being faithful to his or her spouse, etc. And I think that this kind of focus of life and of energy for me, because I have this sense of vocation, is kind of magnifies my ability to love and to serve. I think if it goes sour, it's just the opposite. The vow of chastity is a way of loving. It's not like an endurance contest. I mean, especially when you're younger, it might feel more like that.
Yeah.
But it is actually, in its healthiest expression, a way to love.
Yes. And that resonates for me. I mean, I've never taken that vow, but there is an intuitive level at which I kind of feel my way into it and that it makes sense to me. I don't mean to hit you with something tough here, but it probably makes sense for me to invite you to comment on the sexual scandals that have plagued the Catholic Church around the whole issue of chastity and celibacy. What's your
Certainly.
Perspective on that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do so. I think many people say, well, if priests were able to marry, then we wouldn't have this pedophilia issue. I think that's a kind of simplistic approach. I believe that some of it, at least my little understanding, and I've tested a lot of candidates to religious orders, to the holy orders, diaconate, priesthood, and so forth, and consulted with numerous religious orders and some dioceses, and have dealt with many, many clergy and religious over all these years. And my sense is that the abuses have to do more with psychological immaturity on the part of the clergy rather than an expression of them being celibate. They, years ago, before Vatican II, the seminary training it kind of kept the seminarian, the student, in a very immature status in my view. They were, you know, very much molded in a certain way. They had very little authority. They were treated like children, and sometimes they're 25, 28, 30 years old. Mm-hmm. And now, this isn't across the board, but I mean, a kind of a general observation, you would, this could, most people would say this was probably how it often went, but not always.
Okay.
At any rate, then after that, they're somehow magically ordained, and they're put in a parish, and they're supposed to be dealing with literally life and death issues, marriage, family, death, divorce, struggles, depression, all of those kinds of things. And I don't know that how mature they were themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But again, one of these deeper expressions of Vatican Council II was to update seminary training, update the way clergy and religious are formed or encouraged to grow. And there's a lot healthier approach to all of this today than there was. And you'll find that a lot of these cases of pedophilia, many of them are very old. Oftentimes the perpetrator is dead, I'm 61, so I have to watch how I say this. They're in their 60s, 70s, 80s sometimes. And so a lot of this was happening before the council was implemented. I mean, it's not a panacea, but I do think helping people to grow in a mature way was the major issue, and not the fact that there was a church requirement that clergy, and only in the Latin rite of the Roman Church, be celibate. There are certainly many Catholic priests who are married. They're Byzantine, Ukrainian, and they're all part of the universal church with the Pope as their patriarch. It's just the rite that we're the church that we're familiar with, the Latin rite of the Roman Church.
Okay. Now, at some point in your development, you were drawn into psychology, and you actually went to graduate school and became a psychologist. How did that come about, and when was that?
I think that was when I was 5 years old. I didn't really know there were such things as psychologists. And I mean, many people, families certainly all have their struggles and pain, and our family had its share of it. We weren't morose or anything, but my mother died when I was 2. My oldest sibling has cerebral palsy, has been institutionalized all of his life, but is one of the most joyful spirits you'll ever meet. And so I think there was, I've never known life without a sense of death and dying having been in it. It was always part of life, and as was illness. So I think that somehow I intuited that there's a deeper meaning to life, not just playing, and that called me to psychology. When I entered my order, you have an initial period called postulancy. It's transitional novitiate, where you study the rule and the vows and meditation, and that's a very secluded several years. And then you take temporary vows, and even during those years, in those days, it was more secluded. But I eventually asked permission to study psychology. We had just opened, my order, a new college in the 60s, a private Catholic college, when a lot of other operations like that were folding. We were doing one. I guess we were sort of foolhardy. But so a lot of our younger members were encouraged to go there. We didn't have a psychology department, so I wound up majoring in English, but it was really taking the general courses. And then after 2 years of that, in those days, we used to go out and teach in one of our schools, since a lot of us did that, and it gave you a sense of what that would be like. I did that, and before I went back, I got permission to transfer to a college called Moravian College in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that had a very nice psych department, and I did get that permission, and I was the first one to go kind of out of our usual places of education, and it was absolutely transformative. Dr. Rick Johnson was the head of the department, and that department was pure behaviorism. It was anything you could not weigh or measure didn't have any place there, whether it was soul or ego or anything like that. It was rats, pigeons, monkeys, and all of that. But I loved it. And Dr. Johnson, just the way he talked to me or treated me, I nonverbally knew he had a sense that I could do well in this. And I did. My grades were okay, but when I got to Moravian, they just went way up, got on the dean's list, all that kind of stuff. And it just encouraged me to continue on and really helped me to see the power of a word or a look or the what we reinforce. And and I finished that. Then what happened? Oh,
you went to doctoral school at some point.
Yeah, I had a master's degree in the middle there.
Okay.
As I was finishing at Moravian, a dear friend of mine, still he and his wife are dear friends, was applying to grad school, and I was thinking, oh no, grad school, that's beyond me, or I have to get out and work for the order here or something like that. But I did fill out some forms to go to grad school, and I threw out a form that was to get apply for a scholarship, because it was $25 more, and I didn't want to, you know, take that from the community, although they would have given it. But at the last minute, I pulled it out of the trash can, filled it out, I wound up getting a scholarship, and I went to Catholic University of America for my master's, and just loved it, sailed through it. And then from there, I went out and was a psychology teacher and a guidance counselor in one of our schools for a few years. And I always had the feeling, I think I want, maybe I can get a doctorate. Mm-hmm. And while I was out doing that, I asked permission, and within a few years, I wound up at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, for my doctorate.
Yeah. And what was their orientation?
Lehigh was very much, I would say, humanistic, very person-centered, and yeah, it was very nice. I actually started out at Lehigh in their what was then called a Doctor of Arts program, and it was almost pure research. And I didn't realize there was no clinical component at all. And Lehigh was very much tied into Bethlehem Steel, the famous Bethlehem Steel that doesn't really exist anymore, and Billy Joel sings about in his song about Allentown,
sure,
sort of the demise of all that. And so Lehigh is very much an engineering school and very much nuts and bolts and research. So the psychology program was very much like that too. I eventually was able to transfer to the College of Education that had a wonderful counseling program. It was really like a clinical counseling psychology program, although it was in the College of Education. And I finished there. It only took me 5 years. And it was a good experience. And out of that came my dissertation, which I never wanted to look at again. But just recently, I dusted it off and gave a whole talk on it.
Yeah, I noticed that you told me it was on prejudice and religious values in counseling and psychotherapy. What's the thumbnail sketch of that?
In working with people, I was sometimes concerned that they would be sent to clergy or religious who maybe were not well trained, or maybe who could make matters worse, because I knew bad counseling and therapy hurts people. It's just not kind of innocuous. And so I wanted to look at what effect somebody with religious values would have on the client. And in doing that, I unearthed material about prejudice and religious values. And what I found is that some people, that there's a fair amount of prejudice with people with religious values. You don't look like us, you don't pray like us, you don't act like us, that kind of thing. But what the data shows is that it's more with what we might call the letter of the law type people. I go to church because it looks good, or I'm afraid of hell, or what will people think, or it's good for my job. Versus people who have internalized, whether it's the gospel, the Quran, the Jewish Bible, whatever those values are, when they're more internalized and it's more the spirit of the law, that group is very free of prejudice. So it's not the religion you're in, it's your internal or external orientation toward it. And when people come to you for therapy, the more internally oriented therapist, his or her religious values, if they're more integrated, the client can see them better and gets better.
Very, very interesting. This is a topic we could talk about quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think of there's a whole bunch of research, and I forget what the terminology was, but basically on inner directedness versus outer directedness, and also research on the authoritarian personality. And it sounds like both of those, you might have reviewed them actually in your research. They would both have some bearing on it, I would think.
Yes, they do. And I actually listened to one of your podcasts, but I think his name was Dr. Scott Miller.
Yes.
And he was talking about that, these are my words now, but when kind of push comes to shove, the outcome in psychotherapy is primarily dependent on these core qualities of a person, the relationship with the person, the therapeutic alliance.
You're right.
Things like genuineness, respect, warmth, empathy. And that's what study after study shows, that those qualities are more important than type of psychotherapy, whether it's Freudian, Jungian, client-centered, etc., or whether it's a nurse practitioner or a counselor or a psychiatrist or clinical psychologist doing it. It keeps coming back to these core conditions. And to the degree that the client can see them, to that degree, their health, their well-being is facilitated, better outcome. And so, yes, to more internalize these things. Same thing, external religious orientation blocks that, it appears. This is my research now. Mm-hmm. It appears that the client can't see those core values as well and therefore doesn't do as well.
Yeah, you know, and part of what Scott Miller was saying was that a major portion of what makes people get better when psychotherapy is successful has to do with client strengths and client qualities, the resilience and so on that the client brings to that relationship. And so I'm just speculating here that maybe things like authoritarian personality, the degree, you know, where a person would fall on that scale, where a person would fall in terms of inner directedness versus outer directedness, that would be some interesting research to look at in terms of the client side of who succeeds in therapy and who doesn't.
Yes, that would really be a nice next study to look at. I think it's called internal and external locus of control.
There you go.
Yeah, that's the kind of the research body that I think you're looking at.
Yes.
To see where the client is in that regard as well.
Yes.
As the therapist.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I think that would... Do you have any doctoral students working under you that you could sic on that?
Whoa, I'm going to keep it in mind. Every once in a blue moon, I'm on somebody's committee. But
yeah, great.
About it.
Now, I know one of the things that you wanted to talk about was monastic psychology, and I don't know if you had a chance to say everything that you wanted to say about that. So here's an opening.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I think I have. It's a shame that so many callings in life are misperceived or stereotyped, because I do hear it a lot that, oh, you're not the stereotypical Catholic or monk or whatever.
Yes.
But there are plenty of us around. I guess my main point is that when monastic life is lived in a healthy way, it is something that facilitates growth and new life. As I think any life choice we make for any lifestyle is, that's the point of it. And I think I've pretty much said what I need to. Just also maybe the idea that in talking about the vow of chastity earlier, priestly celibacy, like parish priests who are not in religious orders, they're not like Franciscans or Dominicans or Jesuits, they're under a bishop, they're celibate because of a church law, you know, and I respect all of that, but it is a promise of celibacy. It's not a vow of chastity. A vow is only made to God. The promise is made to in front of their local bishop, and that tradition could be changed, as I said earlier. And for example, let's say an Episcopal married priest becomes a Catholic and wants to be ordained in the Catholic tradition, then he, of course, retains his marriage and so forth. So there are certainly married priests around. But the whole goal of monasticism is to seek God. In a like a teaching order or a nursing order, the order like I was in originally, they're usually founded to do a certain work, missionary work or run hospitals or clinics. In monastic life, it's kind of the opposite. The whole goal of monasticism, we really ought to look a little foolish and a little like we don't fit in. And it's to spend our life seeking God. And out of that may flow some ministry. Some orders are more cloistered and you really don't see monks or nuns. Other orders are more active and so you will interact with them more. Actually, a nice little distinction would be we tend to think of women vowed religious as, we call them all nuns, but strictly speaking, most of the time we're dealing with sisters. Sisters are in active orders, teaching, nursing, doing things like that. Nuns are more cloistered, more focused on silence, on chanting the divine office, the liturgy of the hours, that sort of thing.
Okay, that's wonderful background to have. Now, one of the things that really struck me about the things that you're involved in was not only are you a Catholic monk and a psychologist involved in behavioral medicine, which we haven't talked about yet, but also in natural medicine or naturopathy and Eastern healing, Chinese medicine, Qigong. Tell us about this. How did this, all of this come about? I find it wonderfully refreshing that you're involved in all of this, and it's so stereotype breaking for me, and I need my stereotypes broken. So I'm really delighted by all of that.
It's as surprising to me as it is to anyone else, I think. It's really the God of surprises who called me into this. When I was a postulant and a novice, 17, 18, very cloistered, we were only allowed to read certain books, spiritual books, and maybe there were 100 or so on the shelf. And some of the ones who made the cut were written by or about Thomas Merton.
Sure, I've heard of him.
Great. Thomas Merton died in the late 60s in Bangkok. He was a famous Trappist monk. It's kind of a St. Augustine figure. He had kind of a wild youth, and then when he found God and his life sort of had a different slant or meaning, he entered a very cloistered monastery. Anyway, I read those books, and Merton drew me to the East. He was among the first to bridge the gap between Eastern and Western spirituality to create a whole, not creating a hybrid religion. He, like I, remained faithful to Jesus as our root guru, you might say, in the Eastern parlance, and the gospel and so forth, but that there was a lot we could share and a lot we could reverence in one another. And so reading Merton just drew me very much to monasticism, to the East, to meditation. Meditation has been a constant in my life. I just find it so life-giving, empowering, healing. Helps me to live my vows well, and all of that drew me to the East. I saw the word Qigong somewhere along the line when we were allowed to read broader and broader areas when we were not so restricted, and that absolutely captivated me. So I read everything I could on it, and I practiced little techniques of Qigong, just little movements of the hand and trying to sense energy. And I read the Gospels, and I prayed over Jesus's healing and stories where people felt something, power, where Jesus said, "I felt power going out of me when a woman touched the tassel of his cloak," and so forth. And I believe that all healing comes from God. But I believe that we are all channels of it, vehicles of it, as the other Francis says, Francis of Assisi, "Make me an instrument of your peace." I believe we're all instruments of that. So Chinese medicine was a wonderful way to express that.
So you somehow went on to do some training then in natural, in Chinese medicine and in natural medicine. I noticed one of your degrees is Doctor of Natural Medicine.
That's right. I, after becoming a psychologist, I was already training kind of informally and reading about Chinese medicine, spirituality, meditation, Qigong. And then after my doctorate and I was practicing, I studied a little Qigong and Tai Chi, sometimes with private teachers, and would do some reading. And where it really escalated and exploded was in the late 80s when I received this permission to live as a solitary monk, and which was very frightening. I was very content staying in my own order, but my spiritual director and a bishop and the canon lawyers we consulted all had a sense, as I did, that I was called to live as a monk. Anyway, and my thought was, well, does that mean that this a community that will evolve around me? And to some degree, that did. But what really took off was Chinese medicine. Opportunities came up. A friend of mine, a dear friend who's a Jesuit, ministers in Asia a lot. He was there a lot of his life. Now he's ministering in Chinatown in New York City. He applied for some sort of a grant to get me to go over to Hong Kong to a retreat house he was running. And I went over there and I gave some retreats to therapists and workshops and all kinds of things and got immersed in Chinese culture for, well, I was only there about 3 weeks that time, but I've been back a number of times since. And one of the highlights there was meeting a hermit Qigong master. Would you like me to tell you about that?
Yeah, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, I was longing to meet somebody in the Asian tradition in Asia who did Qigong. And a friend of my Jesuit friend, it's a married couple, she said, oh, I'm going to find somebody for you. But anyway, I was off to this Chinese Buddhist monastery for a couple days by myself with these monks and nuns, who are about 100 in the forest. And the guest master said to me that I would be all alone one day because they were having this big meeting, and would I be all right? And I said, oh, I certainly will be fine. And I was gazing out at the forest in the front of the monastery. I had just done some Qigong. I was sitting there, and I heard a little whisper in my ear, I want to take you to my hut in the woods. And it didn't even startle me, and I turned my head, and there was this little man with a shaved head. He was a hermit from the woods. Hmm. I have no idea how he knew I was there. And I thought, well, this will either be fun or he'll kill me, but I'm going to go. So I went with him into the forest, and we walked along for a while. And he was telling me all these things about myself. He was reading my chi. I missed most of it because of his accent. And he could have just sort of observed it somehow, too. But he was talking about me being very involved in working with other people and in helping them with healing and loving travel and those kinds of things. We finally got to his hut, which was a little cinder block house, maybe two rooms. And he did a tea ceremony, covered my legs with blanket and made the tea and bowed, and we talked about Qigong. It was just marvelous. And then we did a little medical Qigong treatment on one another. Then he took me out, and the day before, an old hermit nun had died in that forest, and a helicopter came in and got her out. We were walking by, and there were little huts here and there. And I thought to myself when I passed one of the huts, I wonder if that's where that hermit nun died. And he just nodded his head, yes. Mm. It's like he read my mind. It was just amazing.
Wow.
And then he took me to a place where he used to meditate, which was on the cliff. And he didn't go there anymore because there were too many ghosts, he said. Well, I think they all fell over the cliff. That's why there were so many ghosts there. I'm holding onto a bush. I didn't want to be any near the edge.
Yeah.
And he's dancing right at the tip of it, doing all this Qigong movement, and the wind's howling and so forth. And it was just a highlight of my life. Then he took me back to a little path, and he bowed to me and just kind of disappeared. And I walked up the path, and I was back to the monastery. And that was like a major kind of infusion of qi or a release of qi that took all my book learning and working one-to-one with teachers and so forth, and just, I don't know, it was like throwing a match on to gasoline.
Wow.
Yeah,
it was spectacular. What a great story. You encountered your Yoda.
Oh, that's right. That must be it. Exactly. Yeah. Then I was able to do some a couple years of wonderful online study in the herbal medicine, Chinese herbal medicine. And it was wonderful. I'd listened to these. There were tapes then and emails and all over and over and over again until I completed that course of training. And then I put it all together in a bridge program at what's now Arkansas College of Natural Health. They have a bridge program. If you're licensed and degreed, you can get into this program, and they'll transfer in everything that will fit that curriculum, and then you take whatever courses are remaining, and it includes a year of a supervised internship. And so then I got this postgraduate Doctor of Natural Medicine degree, which is interdisciplinary. You can enter it from allopathic medicine or nursing or psychology or Chinese medicine, and that's been a blessing as well.
Oh, very, very interesting. Well, and I see that you also teach workshops. Where are you teaching those? What do they cover?
I believe that God speaks to us through many ways, some of which is through other people inviting us to things. So if I'm invited to give a workshop or a retreat, and it seems compatible or appropriate, I will try to respond to that. I have twice a year, I have a Qigong day. I must have a couple hundred people on our mailing list. So it could be 60 people might show up for that. There's an ashram 5 miles from here. God is so providential, so good. And I have a wonderful relationship with this Hindu ashram. I use their facilities, and we'll spend a whole day doing Qigong, meditating, discussing. Every fall and spring we have that. I will give more spiritual retreats that maybe are done largely in silence for a week or so. Maybe do some Qigong in the morning and evening with the folks. Perhaps chat with them individually if they wish to come in to meet with me. So they're at various retreat houses, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, wherever people invite me to come. And some of this is very ecumenical. I'm soon to give a Qigong retreat to a women's group from St. Gabriel's Episcopal Church. And there's another group that I'm going to give a little workshop with, who are divorced, separated, widowed men and women who would like some support. And sometimes I was in Punta Cana. I never thought I couldn't even pronounce it last year. Punta Cana, the Dominican Republic. That was in October, November for 4 or 5 days. A beautiful setting. I was invited to help a little bit with a workshop, a conference of about 400 people. It was for working with people of color. And they were so edifying, so life-giving. The woman who invited me is the dean of Stony Brook University School of Social Work, and she's a kind of Mother Teresa, a Baptist Mother Teresa. She has helped so many people along, and a lot of these people were doctors and lawyers and senators and all that stuff, and I was just honored to be there. So it's a wide variety of places. Traditional Chinese Medicine World Foundation, Dr. Nan Liu, is a wonderful man. He has this foundation and offices in New York City. I was helping to present at his annual conference last fall, and I'll be doing it again next fall in Virginia. So a wide variety of settings and wherever people call me. Some of it's more focused clearly on the spiritual. Some of it's more health-oriented.
Well, if you ever do anything here on the West Coast, be sure to let me know. I'd love to come.
Particularly, that would be an honor.
Yeah, particularly something in Northern California. Yeah, I would love to have a chance to meet you in person, interact with you. I really feel very drawn to you based on our emails and our communication here today. As we wrap things up here, I wonder if you have any word of advice or message for our listeners. Not that there hasn't been a lot already, but I just, maybe there's some final thought that you'd like to share with people.
Yes, what comes to mind is to be careful not to mix up the core or the substance of who we are with the accidents or the surface ways in which we have been treated or mistakes we may have made. I believe we're created in God's image. The Buddha consciousness is there, different ways of trying to express this. And that's who we are, and it's like a diamond, and nothing can destroy that. But life slings mud at us, or people hurt us or abuse us, or we do dumb things, and we start to think that's what we are. Mm-hmm. So I just invite us all to go in more deeply, whether it's through meditation or breathing or just being with a good friend, and find the core of who we are and try to live out of that.
Mm, that's a wonderful message to leave us with. Brother Bernard, thanks so much for being, or it's Bernard. I say Bernard. I had a boyhood friend who was named Bernard, but it's Bernard. So Brother Bernard, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Brother Bernard as much as I did. I was really intrigued when he first showed up on my radar screen. Actually, it wasn't radar. He showed up on the Frapper map. And I noted there that there was something in his self-description, I guess it was the brother title, that drew my eye to the fact that he was a monk in Pennsylvania. And this kind of question mark went off in my head. A monk in Pennsylvania? What's that about? What kind of weirdness might this be? And then I think I got a listener email from him. And so that led me to Google him. There was something in the signature, I think, that caught my eye. And so I thought, I'm going to Google this guy. Seems like he could be a fascinating person. And sure enough, I found his website, and it was very interesting to find this man who is a psychologist. He's a naturopath. He's a specialist in Chinese medicine, engaged in Tai Chi and Qigong and meditation. You know, all of my sort of hot button magic words. So then we had some very nice email exchanges, and I invited him. I said, asked him if he would be interested in appearing as a guest. And he was not only willing, but enthusiastic and eager, and even went to the lengths of going out and buying a USB headset so that we could have a Skype conversation, which led to better quality than when I'm using Skype out and just talking to someone on a regular phone. So I'm very grateful that he was willing to do that. And as I hope you experienced in the interview, Brother Bernard radiates love and acceptance and enthusiasm. These are healing qualities in and of themselves. And I really find myself both during the interview, before and after, liking him quite a bit. I feel like he brought some healing. I feel like the interview brought me some healing of my own stereotypes about Catholicism. In a previous interview, I think I talked about my own kind of religious background in terms of growing up with an evangelist set of grandparents, my grandmother in particular. And part of that fundamentalist Christian upbringing, that programming really, had to do with a kind of anti-Catholic bias in which I was told that Catholics engage in idol worship, that they worship the idol or the statue of the Virgin Mary, and that they worship the statues of the various saints. And so therefore, they're not real Christians, and blah, 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 on it went. And, you know, as much as I feel like I've transcended a lot of that very narrow early programming, when you get that stuff at such an early age, it's still in there somehow, you know, that kind of religious prejudice. It's not easy to overcome, but I feel like this interview and this contact that I've had with Brother Bernard really has helped me to overcome that. It broadens the possibilities of what's possible within Catholicism, at least within his brand and his expression of it I can relate to that. So it was very good for me to have contact with someone like him, especially at a time when the Catholic Church has been getting such a bad rap. Clearly, he has a very strong inner spiritual drive, and he's had that from a very early age. And it's wonderful to find people in an established religion, such as Catholicism, who have this sort of tolerance and breadth and open-mindedness. He's also very generous. He sent me 4 books that he's written and a videotape on Qigong. And I haven't had a chance to read these books yet, but I'm really looking forward to it because it turns out that the 4 slim volumes that he sent me are actually murder mysteries in which the hero is a monk, surprisingly. Let me read to you from the cover of one of the books. The series is called From the Office of the Dead, and then each book has a title. And for example, this one that I'm looking at is called Morning Prayer, and then the subtitle is From the Office of the Dead, and each of the 4 volumes has that. And it says here on the back cover, there's a nice picture of Brother Bernard. And it says, the mystery team is at it again. This time, the 6 good friends travel to the land of mystery and intrigue, Tibet, via Nepal and Bangkok. Having started their journey, but not even out of America yet, they are drawn into a search for an ancient dorje, a scepter-like object used during Tibetan Buddhist prayer services. The dorje, however, quickly becomes the least of their challenges. Fertile with information about Asian medicine and spirituality, this book is presented in a light and humorous fashion through the minds and hearts of single, married, male, female, lay, and monastic characters. The great religions of the world are also represented, and a hopeful, agnostic familiar to our readers is an integral part of the action as well. Third in the Office of the Dead series, Morning Prayer is a complete monastic murder mystery containing characters which develop out of the first 2 complete books, Office of the Dead and Vigils. Experience friendship and danger through the psyche of a Christian monk / doctor along with his friends as he connects with Tibetan Buddhist monks and nuns for some continuing education credits that he will never forget. Enjoy your trip to Tibet, a kingdom also known as the top of the world. So now we have to add novelist and mystery writer to all of his other credits. And I think you could purchase these books on Brother Bernard's website, and I will put a link to his website on our show notes. And then after the interview, we stayed online, and I hit him up for some free alternative health advice. He had great information for me on my particular medical topic of interest. So as a result of the contact that I've had with Brother Bernard, I find myself feeling more open, more open-minded, more generous, and more optimistic. Isn't that interesting? I hope something similar happened for you.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
As usual, Shrink Wrap Radio is sponsored by Podshow and GoDaddy. You can actually subscribe to Shrink Wrap Radio from the Podshow site at podshow.com if you're not already subscribed. And at Podshow, you'll find a very colorful interface linking you to lots of audio and video podcast content. And you'll find great discounts for all your domain name and web hosting needs on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Just look for the GoDaddy link and it'll take you to the place where you can get information about those discounts. And some of you have taken advantage of those, and I want to thank you for that. It does send a little bit of that money our way. And if you haven't filled it out yet, you'll find our listener survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm, and there's a link on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And if you include your name and email address, you'll get a little surprise. We've got one new addition to our Frapper map, so a big thank you and welcome to Mike in Southampton, England. And if you're not on our Frapper map, you can find a place on our website where you can do that. In the last episode, I put out a call for some help with editing the interview audio files, and I've had two volunteers step forward, Fernando Blanco in Mexico City and Anthony Bartlett in the UK. So thanks, guys, for stepping forward, and at some point, you may be hearing their handiwork. We're working out the details of file transfer and so on right now.
Hi, this is Lloyd from Australia, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Lloyd, thanks for that transition you sent some time back and for all your emails. And speaking of emails, let's take a quick dip into the mailbag. Here's the first one. Dear Dr. Dave, I hope this email finds you in the best of health and happiest of moods. This is the second time I'm writing to you to give you feedback about Shrink Wrap Radio. The podcast is wonderful. It's all in capital letters. And I've been delighted by your more lengthy shows, as more content is exactly what we all need without depriving us of your commentary. Recently, there was an interview where you expressed some healthy skepticism about some techniques your guest was touting. I was thrilled to hear it, as I was having some pretty serious doubts about the validity of what your guest was claiming. Your podcast gives such a lovely balance between wonder, curiosity, and educated skepticism. Keep up the great work. I appreciate how much time, money, and effort you put into the show. As a therapist, I feel obligated to remind you that hobbies can become obligations, and to keep that from happening, you need balance, and don't put your fans first. You are best when you are happy to be podcasting and not feeling stressed / obligated. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox now. Thank you again for such a magnificent podcast. The guests have been intriguing. You have some amazing friends. Wow. Carpe diem. Warmly. And it comes from Brandy in Danville, Virginia. And Brandy is a social worker. So I'm always so happy to have other mental health professionals who are listeners and who feel so supportive. So thank you so much. And Brandy, I will try to take your wonderful therapeutic advice to heart and keep it in mind. Okay, this next one comes from Dennis El Tortugo, as he signs himself in his emails, and we've corresponded before. He says, Dave, I'm enjoying the emails as I write on your latest podcast. I enjoyed your going over your reading. He's referring to my tarot reading. It was very informative. I personally like the unedited quality and the more relaxed to no or little notes. If I were to interview people, I would need an outline to be sure I covered all the points I wanted to cover. A thought I had about building a community, if you want to, is to have a forum of some kind or a Yahoo group or a tribe. There people could get to know you and each other. It also could advertise just by existing. Well, that's my two cents. Dennis, who, if I recall correctly, is in Las Vegas. And he says, P.S., I really like that format where it's you talking without an interviewee. Yeah, that felt like a little bit of a risk for me to put myself out there, but I thought, hey, it's my podcast. Why not? And I am really enjoying the flexibility of doing more ad-libbing here and just working from an outline, which I did in this one as well. And I'm feeling more freedom and more confidence, and this kind of email helps to support me in that resolve. So thanks for that, Dennis. And then we hear one last one here from Susie, who says, Hi, Dr. Dave. I just went to my first visit with a Jungian analyst. I'm very excited. I told her how I really enjoyed learning about the hero's journey, and she said, Well, have you learned about the heroine's journey, which I had never heard about? The heroine's journey is quite different from the hero's journey. I think this would make a great topic. Ciao for now, Susie. Okay, well, I must admit, I don't know as much about the heroine's journey. I've always felt that the hero's journey really applied to both male and female, but I do know that there has been work since the work of Joseph Campbell that more precisely defines the situation for women and that women have really resonated to. And so there are a couple of authors that come to mind, if I could get them. Clarissa Pinkola Estes wrote Women Who Run with Wolves, and Jean Shinoda Bolen, who I met some years ago, has written a number of books about mythology and women's issues. And here's a synchronicity for you. The next one I'm going to mention is a book by Maureen Murdoch called The Heroine's Journey. So I went on, I knew that there was a book by that title out there, and I wanted to get the author's name. And so I went to Amazon, and I had just retrieved her name. And up on my email comes another email from Susie. Now, Susie sent me this email a day or two ago, the original one that I just read. And up pops this email just as I'm composing this show. And as I'm reading Susie's letter, I get an email from her saying, by the way, Maureen Murdoch wrote Heroine's Journey. Whoa, that Jungian analysis, it's starting to do something. I think that better wrap it up for today. Don't forget you can send your emails to shrink at shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And I'm encouraging you to leave voice messages and transitions on MyChingo, and you'll find a link to that, a logo there, on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-888-2746. Thanks again to Brother Dr. Bernard Seif for the interview. And speaking of synchronicities, after the synchronicity I just encountered with Susie, I realized there is another synchronicity, inasmuch as our next episode, already recorded, is an interview on the very topic of synchronicity with Dr. Gibbs Williams, who says Jung got it all wrong. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.